did. They yes. attacked another country, the Roman Empire, for example, or even went to the Persian Empire, attacked, did raids, and then kidnapped women and children and men.
Yes, many ways, unfortunately, yeah. for the in an oppressive way, they took some slaves.
Yes.
Islam, from the beginning, it said that you are not allowed to do such a thing for doing slavery.
Right.
This is for the beginning. And second, it was that best worship from the view of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and best deeds is to free slaves.
Yes. So many narrations about freeing
slaves. So many narrations, it has been counted to be kind of best kind of worship
yes.
to free some slaves. For example, we have that Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, he freed more than a thousand slaves from his own, wages of work.
The Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, used to buy slaves and then just free them.
Yes, yes. From these Islamic points, let me mention another point, final points about the behavior of Ahlul Bayt, like
Please
Imam
do.
Hassan, Imam Sadiq, alayhi
yes.
salatu wasalam. They freed the slaves for some of the slaves they gifted Imam, alayhi salam, okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
For example, some flowers. And Imam freed that slave because of this few, gift that he or she gave Imam, alayhi salatu wasalam.
Yes.
You see how I think we can guess what is Islamic system of, slavery, you can call it. It is gradual abolition and
exactly.
practical abolition of slavery, because it was not possible in that time to go and harshly,
no more slavery in a society that had so many slaves.
Actually, it was not possible, and it was not for the benefit of slaves themselves
right.
to do that. But the wisest way for Islam and more practical way is to have practical abolition of slavery.
It's a gradual process because you are changing a whole society.
Yes.
And you
yes.
want to convince him that there is one God, for example, that's what whole Islam is about.
Yes.
And then you go and say, yeah, but also no slavery. You got to
yes.
work on them step by step. They need to have some iman, some faith, before they can follow you through
yes.
such a huge societal change.
Yeah. I think in this system, you can have this gradual, abolition of slavery.
Right.
Or, for example, let me share one verse of Noble Quran. وَعْبُدُ اللَّهُ وَلَا تُشْرِكُوا بِهِ شَيْئًا وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا. I skip this part of the verse. Do not ascribe any partner to him and worship only Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and be good to parent, to relative, to travelers, and be good to companions at your side, and to the slaves.
وَمَا مَلَكَتْ أَيْمَانُكُمْ. To those that you own.
Yeah, to those people that slave that you own, be nice to them, to have nice treatment
right.
with them, and be good to them. This is a verse of Noble Quran. In this way, Islam wanted to actually educate and to have some kind of education for the poor slaves, some Islamic education for them.
Right.
And after this Islamic education and nice treatment to slaves, you see how
yeah.
Islam embraced this kind of, generations of the slaves. After this embracement of Islam and giving them nice education, nice treatment, they become
right.
one, like other members of Islamic society,
no,
they become useful,
yeah.
For Islamic society and of course for their own societies and communities.
Exactly. So the abolishment of slavery, it was a gradual process because we were forced to have a gradual process. But some might say, well, practically, why was it a gradual process? What do we say to this question, dear Sheikh?
As I said, it was not possible. It was not for the benefit of the slaves themselves to do that.
How so, dear Sheikh?
If Islam was saying that it is forbidden from now on to have any slaves, what those slaves, what those destitute slaves were doing in that
right.
time?
Many
okay?
of them foreigners,
there is
example.
No food for them. There is no work. There is no
right.
job. Nothing. Nobody can afford them. Okay.
Right.
But by this process, okay, Islam gave a lot of emphasis and encouragement for people to have this kind of, nice treatment with them.
Right.
But gradually abolished this slavery, and of course nobody can have slaves anymore.
Right, and with that, we want to say a lot more, of course, dear Sheikh, but we are unfortunately out of time. I thank the dear Sheikh for his time and for his wonderful knowledge and insight. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. Fi amanillah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Li Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The tragedies caused by the Saudi-led war on Yemen are going beyond the casualties of airstrikes and an ongoing blockade. The Yemeni Pediatric Society says the number of infants with birth defects has increased rapidly since the 2015 war that turned Yemen into a testing ground for internationally banned weapons.
The weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition against our country contain prohibited chemicals that directly affect pregnant women and fetuses. That has increased the birth rate of children with cancer and congenital anomalies, especially in the areas that are being continuously bombed, such as Sana'a, Hudaydah, Hajja, and Sada.
Officials say chemical and biological bombs dropped from Saudi warplanes on Yemenis have made Yemen the world's worst epidemic disaster. They're calling for an investigation into recent cases of congenital anomalies.
Since the first day of the aggression, the Saudi-led coalition has used various types of prohibited weapons, including cluster and phosphorus bombs, to target residential and agricultural areas. As a result of environmental contamination, we witnessed a dramatic rise of congenital malformations amongst children. We demand the documentation of the pathological cases caused by these bombs to reveal Saudi Arabia's war crimes.
Infants are suffering a difficult condition in Yemen in the absence of essential medical supplies and healthcare facilities needed for their survival and well-being. Yemeni health centers have been in a dire situation since the start of the Saudi-led war.
As the war goes on, Yemeni children continue to be at the brunt of the death and destruction left behind by Saudi-banned weapons. People here believe that Riyadh has always been violating international law by using cluster munitions in bombing residential areas since it started its deadly war on Yemen. Abd Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The U.S. is stunned by a devastating storm of tornadoes that ripped through the six states of Arkansas, Illinois, Kentucky, Missouri, Mississippi, as well as Tennessee overnight. Strong thunderstorms triggered dozens of tornadoes that crumbled metal like paper, swatted down concrete buildings, and threw a freight train off its track. Among notable casualties are a candle-making factory in Kentucky, a nursing home in Arkansas, and an Amazon warehouse in Illinois. An Illinois resident explains how he was shocked by the extent of damage after he rushed to his mother's house.
The damage is worse than some of the stuff I've seen in war pictures, so it's pretty intense. You know, it's not anything that I thought when she called me and told me that, oh, all my trees are gone. I was like, I got here and I did not expect to see this.
The town of Mayfield in Kentucky was described as ground zero by officials and appeared post-apocalyptic. A restaurant owner says the town's residents have lost it all.
It was just, this is our hometown, and it's just devastating. Everybody's lost everything.
Rescue workers across the middle of the country are combing through wreckage for survivors. Scores of deaths have already been confirmed, and officials warn that the toll is almost certain to rise as they are sifting through the ruins for the missing. President Joe Biden is going to travel to areas affected by what he's described as likely one of the largest tornado outbreaks in the American history.
I'm monitoring the situation very closely since early this morning. This is likely to be one of the largest tornado outbreaks in our history. And it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy.
President Biden also said he would task the environmental agencies to take a look at the specific impact climate change might have had on the deadly tornadoes. A meteorologist says he has rarely seen anything like this tornado storm during his career spanning four decades.
I was watching the radar last night and I was saying, wait a second. This is December. How is this happening in December? This is the kind of thing you would only see at the height of the season, you know, March, April, May. I'd never seen anything like this this time of year. I mean, and you hardly ever see something like this in a career.
The tornadoes have left a trail stretching around 370 kilometers. The multi-state disaster has freshened debates about whether climate change had a role to play in triggering these tornadoes, which are believed to be quite unseasonal, and whether a warmer planet would mean the world should expect to see more disasters of the kind.
Afghans say the Taliban takeover of the country has not brought an end to terrorist attacks there. In addition to three large mosque blasts, recently IED bomb attacks have been continuously taking lives in the capital, Kabul. People say they're worried about such time-to-time bomb attacks, most of which carried out by Daesh.
People thought that bomb attacks will come to an end after the Taliban takeover, but we still do not feel safe. We live in the west of Kabul. Here, we witness explosions every week. We ask the Islamic Emirate to take the security seriously.
Yesterday, an explosion hit a civilian vehicle here. Many were killed and wounded. Recently, people have been fearful of roadside and IED bomb attacks. The terrorists place bombs inside buses and everywhere, so people don't dare to take a bus or walk safely.
But Taliban officials have stressed that there is no place for Daesh or other terrorist groups in Afghanistan.
There is no active or observable terrorist group in Afghanistan. The Islamic Emirate has strong control over Afghanistan. No group or individual dares to stand against the Islamic Emirate or threaten the nation. However, there have been sporadic movements under the name of Daesh to create terror, but our forces are following them and will dismantle them soon.
The waves of terror attacks come as the Afghan society is struggling with unemployment, poverty, and hunger. People say they're disappointed, being hit by all these catastrophes. On Friday here in western Kabul, two explosions hit civilian targets, killing two and injuring at least four. The attacks were claimed by Daesh terrorist group. The continuation of such incidents is raising concerns among the people. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
It was only last month when the statements by Lebanon's then Information Minister George Kordahi made headlines. In a televised interview recorded in August, before his appointment as a minister, Kordahi said the war in Yemen was futile and that Saudi Arabia and the UAE were the aggressors in that conflict. But it didn't take long for him to become the target of an unprecedented pressure campaign conducted by Saudi Arabia and its allies. In a bid to ease the tensions, Kordahi decided to leave office, a move he says he did not feel good about in the first place.
When I resigned, I did not feel good about being forced to step down. If Lebanon did not have these current problems and crisis and bankruptcy, I would have no reason to resign. And the government could have opposed my resignation and the whole Lebanese nation would have rejected it. For 40 days, I was under pressure from all sides, forcing me to resign. I resisted for 40 days. I could have resisted for 40 years, but I needed to consider the national interests.
Kurdahi says he resigned to put the interest of Lebanese people first, but he says he's surprised at the extent of the influence external players exerted to make him step down.
We have hardly ever seen a government demanding the resignation of a minister or an official in another country, or setting it as a condition where a country has no choice but to comply. This has not happened, but in Lebanon, it is the second time that such a thing is happening. I have not disrespected anyone. 2 months before a ministerial appointment, I said something that was in favor of all parties without hurting anyone. Now I feel I have been oppressed.
The former Lebanese minister says his resignation has been a bargaining chip. The French President Emmanuel Macron has used to open talks with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Throughout the whole interview, Kurdahi stresses his firm stance on his previously stated views.
I have borne the cost of my position on the Lebanese resistance and Syria throughout the past 10 years. Today, I also paid the price of my position on Yemen, and I am proud of it. Each media activist is the voice of the people and should not hide the truth.
And when asked if he would retract the statements triggering his forced resignation, he says he would not back down.
I will repeat the same remarks, because I spoke in good faith and did not say anything to offend anyone. This war, the war in Yemen, is an erosive war for both of these countries and all aggressors. Therefore, I demand an end to this years-long war.
Kurdahi resigned for criticizing years of devastating war, a war that has taken the lives of hundreds of thousands of Yemeni people, displacing millions and creating a dire situation that is described by the United Nations as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The death of India's Chief of Defense Staff, Bipin Rawat, his wife and 11 others in a chopper crash on Wednesday made big news across the subcontinent. The report went viral on social media and received huge attention region-wide. Following the incident, a female staffer at one of the Kashmir's leading banks received suspension for what they described as, quote, inappropriate reaction to a social media post about the death of the chief of defense staff, unquote. People in Kashmir are criticizing the suspension, saying this is a violation of their rights to free speech.
Social media hai.
I am not judging her reaction, but emoji symbols are sometimes sent by mistake, since touch screens are highly sensitive. This is highly undemocratic on the part of Kashmir officials.
In the Indian-administered Kashmir, government offices and semi-government institutions have issued circulars and updated codes of conduct cautioning employees against posting anything critical of India or its rule in the region. Scores of people in Kashmir have removed their social media posts out of fear of police action. A police officer who didn't want his name to be disclosed said that only posts that can attract a lot of attention or encourage disruption of public order are being assessed, since Kashmir is a sensitive region. However, analysts say authorities in Kashmir are trying to control the narrative to justify India's decision to end Kashmir's special status in August 2019.
This is depiction or reflection of sense of insecurity which has overtaken Indian state, because they feel if they allow people to express freely, the reality of Kashmir will get exposed before whole of the world.
India is increasingly using its anti-terror laws since the Hindu nationalist party Bharatiya Janata Party came to power in 2014. In Kashmir alone, over 2,300 people have been booked under the law since 2019, and half of them are still in prison. Global human rights bodies, including the United Nations, slammed India last month for arresting Kashmir's human rights activist Khurram Parvez under its anti-terror law. India has dismissed the UN charges as baseless, but people and analysts say repressive techniques are being used to suppress dissent in Kashmir. Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
As the seventh round of talks aimed at reviving the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA continue in Vienna, Iran's lead negotiator Ali Bagheri Kani says some of the issues raised by his team have been accepted, while others have not.
In the course of the talks that have taken place over the past few days, some of these issues were accepted by the other side and some were not. Therefore, we will have a number of issues alongside previous areas of disagreement, which are not too many, that will form the basis for serious discussions at the level of senior negotiators from Iran and the 4+1 countries.
The new Iranian team says it's asking for the verifiable removal of all post-2015 U.S. sanctions before it goes back to full compliance with the JCPOA. Iran has also asked for guarantees the U.S. would not withdraw from the deal again or impose new sanctions that would impede its implementation.
We have a basic logical red line, an agreement that was finalized in 2015 between Iran and the P5+1. The U.S. withdrew from that deal and now it wants to re-enter. So this agreement is a common basis between the two sides. Therefore, we will definitely not accept anything less than the JCPOA. This will definitely be a red line for Iran.
Meanwhile, European officials warn that time is running out amid claims that Iran's demands are stalling progress.
The Europeans know quite well that issues that are unresolved in the previous draft or issues within the previous draft that were in violation of the JCPOA, they will have to be fixed and they will have to be corrected. They understand this. And while the Europeans are speaking about the original draft, but they know quite well where things stand.
According to an EU official, talks are advancing logically, while the Russian delegate has pointed out that certain misunderstandings from the previous week have now been resolved, although reaching a final deal will take time and a lot of effort. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
On Friday, a string of large and smaller school unions held a general strike against the 2022 government's budget law. Unionists complained the law, which is expected to be approved by the end of this year, fails to allocate funds for reasonable adjustments and pay protection for teachers, undermining, quote, for the umpteenth time, the importance of education. Teachers and pupils took to the streets of several Italian cities, including Rome, Milan, Bologna, and Torino, calling on the Mario Draghi-led executive to review the planned budget and finally bring investments into public schools up to EU standards.
L'Italia investe.
Funds destined for the COVID-19 response are higher than those for repairing and maintaining our school buildings. The problem is that school managers don't know how to spend the COVID funds, and the money goes unspent.
Italy invests in education 1 percentage point of GDP less than the European average, which translates into about 17 billion euros, a huge amount of money.
According to union leaders, teachers' national collective contract cannot be renewed if the budget bill remains unvaried. Salary levels have remained much lower than the EU average, and a growing percentage of teachers, about 15%, works under temporary employment.
The government is proposing a 12 euro monthly pay rise in the next collective contract, less than peanuts. They say we should work for the greater good rather than for the money.
With energy costs, pressures continuing to drive consumer price inflation, the cost of living in Italy is on the rise. Italy's annual inflation rate rose to almost 4% in November, the highest level since September 2008.
Italy also plans to set aside about 8 billion euros for tax cuts in its 2022 budget law. Some trade unions say the move will benefit especially the upper middle class rather than low-income households. For this reason, two large trade unions, CGL and WIL, will stage a general strike on December 16. Max Civili, Rome.
Thousands of Palestinians took to the streets of the Gaza Strip to mark the 34th anniversary of Hamas establishment. Al-Qassam Brigade, the armed wing of Hamas, also held a military parade. while other participants waved Hamas flags, chanting slogans in support of the resistance group.
We will keep fighting against the Israeli crimes. We will sacrifice our lives. We will keep defending our rights, and we won't remain silent. There will come a day when we all pray in Al-Aqsa Mosque and liberate our lands.
Addressing the rally, senior Hamas official Mahmoud Al-Zahar said celebrating the movement's establishment indicates that Hamas was founded to unite the Palestinian people and lead them in their struggle against Israeli atrocities.
The Palestinian resistance continues in all parts of Palestine, including the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, as long as the Israeli regime violates our rights and grabs our lands. The resistance will respond to all Israeli attacks. We praise our forces for their last battle against the Israeli attacks in Al-Aqsa and their land grab in Sheikh Jarrah. We will always remain committed to our duties of defending Palestine.
Founded in 1987, Hamas is the largest Palestinian resistance movement. Since 2007, it has ruled the besieged Gaza Strip and has since defended the impoverished enclave against four major Israeli wars, including the most recent 11-day conflict that ended in an Egyptian-provoked ceasefire in May.
Hamas renewed its promise to liberate our land and defend our people. As our struggle against this occupation persists, Palestinian resistance is our shield against this Israeli regime and its violations and crimes against us, and we are certain it won't disappoint us.
People hail the Palestinian resistance for defending their rights and fighting against the Israeli aggression, especially amid the recent wave of normalizing of ties with Israel. Palestinians say they will continue their resistance until the rights of the nation are restored. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Another moment of pride for Iran at the United Nations for its active partnership since joining the world body in 1950. The country has now become a full member of the UN Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation. Iran's accession was approved by a unanimous vote at the Special Political Committee of the UN General Assembly on Tuesday. UNSCEAR rarely expanded to include new members, but under the resolution proposed by Australia, four countries were admitted, raising the number to 31. Norway, Algeria, and the UAE were other nations who joined the body. Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations, Majid Takht Ravanchi, praised the General Assembly's decision to admit Iran into the committee. He expressed Tehran's full support for the body in its scientific endeavors to protect the planet and humans.
Iran reiterates its full support for and cooperation with the UNSCE in order to further enhance the infrastructure capacity and training of its personnel, as well as support nuclear safety, protect the public health and the environment from the harmful effects of atomic radiation.
Iran's accession is perceived as a major step forward since the top UN scientific body on nuclear safety has always been under Western influence. As expected, the decision faced stiff opposition from Israel and the U.S. Takht Ravanchi responded to anti-Iran allegations raised by Israel and the U.S. He said the track record of Tel Aviv and Washington show they are not in a position to oppose Iran's membership to the scientific committee. The Iranian envoy said that while the Israeli regime has flagrantly violated many UN resolutions and defied international efforts to contain weapons of mass destruction, Washington dishonored its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal. A nuclear scientist has hailed Iran's accession to the committee as a very positive step.
In general, it's a good move for Iran. Iran can have send some of its scientists to the mission to join the work and the effort of this committee. I think at the end it will be a very positive step for Iran.
The Vienna-based body was set up by a UN General Assembly resolution in 1955 and is affiliated with the UN Environment Program. The committee is tasked with providing information on nuclear radiation and its associated health risks and hazards. The committee's work has served as a basis for evaluating the risk of nuclear exposure and establishing best practices and protective measures.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Making a biodegradable material strong enough to replace plastic is a tough task, but scientists are trying to do just that. We now present you an article written by Laura Patterson. The piece is titled, The Future of Plastic Alternatives. It comes from bacteria and goes back to bacteria. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. People think about plastic waste, they often think of the packaging that swaddles supermarket fruits and vegetables. Shiny layers that are stripped away and thrown in the bin as soon as the produce is unloaded at home. It's a wasteful cycle that California-based company, Appeal, says it can help end. The firm has developed an edible, tasteless and invisible plant-based spray for fruits and vegetables that works as a barrier to keep oxygen out and moisture in, increasing shelf life without the need for single-use plastic. It's currently being sprayed onto cucumbers and avocados at retailers including Walmart. The CEO of Walmart, James Rogers, said, "We're showing that you can actually reimagine a food system that's not built on the foundation of single-use plastic." Appeal, which is valued at $2 billion, is part of a wave of startups and scientific projects racing to develop materials that could help replace traditional single-use plastics. Their production methods and applications vary widely, but their stated aim is the same, to end the scourge of plastic waste. Since the 1950s, the world has produced an estimated 8.3 billion tons of plastics. Nearly two-thirds of this has ended up in landfill sites or leaching into soil, rivers and oceans. Choking wildlife, plastics are a driver of the climate crisis. The vast majority are made from fossil fuels, and if global production continues on current trends, plastics may account for about 20% of oil consumption by mid-century. The problem is that fossil-based plastics are not easy to replace. Plastic is a wonder material, cheap to produce, lightweight and incredibly durable. The latter is a great quality in use, but not when it ends up in a landfill site or the environment. Plastic can take centuries to degrade. Finding a material that is strong but can be essentially self-destruct when needed is incredibly tough. But plenty of scientists and companies are trying to do just that. Bioplastics have emerged as a popular alternative, even if they currently make up less than 1% of the market. Made from biosources such as sugarcane, algae, even banana waste and shellfish, many pitch themselves as eliminating the need for fossil fuels and also breaking down easily after use. Sarah Kakadelis, a researcher in plastic pollution at Imperial College, University of London, said these green claims do not always stand up to scrutiny. If the raw material is not sourced sustainably, bioplastics could end up increasing deforestation to clear land and competing with food production. They also do not always break down as easily as advertised, sometimes taking years. And others require industrial composting facilities, which can be scarce. Some companies say they have cracked these problems. The Dutch biochemicals company, Avantium, which has partnered with brands such as Carlsberg, has developed a 100% plant-based plastic made from sugars that can be used for bottles and firms. The company says its plastic is 100% recyclable, has a significantly lower carbon footing than fossil-based plastics, and is sourced from sustainably grown plants. If this plastic falls out of the recycling stream, trials have shown that it takes about a year to decompose in an industrial composer. According to initial results from a long-term study with the University of Amsterdam, left in the environment, the plastic starts to degrade after a year. Avantium plans to open its first plant in 2023 in the Netherlands and predicts its packaging will be in supermarkets in just 3 years' time. Other companies are developing plastics that avoid the need for crops altogether. In September, the British-based biotech startup Shellworks launched a plastic made from microbes found in many maritime and soil environments. These feed on carbon sources, building up a fat-like energy storage system. Shellworks co-founder Amir Afshar said, "When his fat is extracted, it behaves exactly like plastic. The difference is, when it returns to nature, the same bacteria see it as food and start to eat it." Afshar said it comes from bacteria and then goes back to bacteria. The company has signed deals with beauty companies to work on products such as tubes, bottles and compacts, which often end up in landfill sites. Co-founder Insia Jafarji said, "When people have finished with Shellworks products, they can be treated like food waste and composted with no special infrastructure needed." Other scientists are trying to turn plastic into a tool for tackling the climate crisis by making plastics from greenhouse gases. Kakadelis said, "One could see in the future capturing carbon dioxide from the air and then using that to produce plastic." Scientists at Rutgers University have developed technology that can turn water and carbon dioxide into precursors for various plastics, which they say could replace PET and polyester fiber, ubiquitous in the fashion industry. About 60% of materials made into clothing is from plastics. Anders Lawson, the chief executive officer of Renew Carbon Dioxide, the startup spun out of Rutgers University research, said the method is essentially replicating nature's process for making oil and gas over millions of years, but doing so in a fraction of a second. The company hopes to harness the CO2 emitted from plastics as they decompose or are incinerated and use it to create new products. Renew Carbon Dioxide is building a pilot plant and expects to reach commercialization in 2025. Increasing consumer pushback on plastics has also led some companies to trial completely different materials. Mars and Unilever are experimenting with paper, which is widely recycled and less harmful than plastics if it ends up in the sea or at a landfill site. This summer, Coca-Cola begins testing a paper bottle in Hungary for one of its drinks, in partnership with Copenhagen-based startup Pabuco, which makes bottles from molded FSC-certified paper pulp. However, these bottles still have a plastic lid and are lined with a recycled PET plastic film which keep the product from leaking or paper fibers from getting in. Pabuco's interim chief executive officer, Gitan Shield, said, "Our ultimate vision is to develop a fully bio-based paper bottle that can also be recyclable in the paper stream." Sander de Vreugde, who leads the new plastics economy initiative at the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, said the big question for these innovations are, where is the material sourced from and where does it end up? For example, paper isn't a sustainable packaging material if it contributes to deforestation, or if the paper bottles and sweet wrappers don't make it into the recycling streams. It is also likely to take many years before these materials can scale up enough to make a dent in the 300 million tons of plastics recovered and produced every year. Mark Miodonik, Professor of Materials and Society at University College London, worries about the proliferation of materials being developed without enough thought about how they fit into existing waste systems. He said, "Mostly what we want to do is actually make plastics that are very durable, and we want to keep them in the stream, so we want to recycle." Where he thinks biodegradability and compostability make sense are products such as caddy liners for food waste bins, tea bags. Why include the plastic that's going to last you 100 years into a tea bag? That's crazy. And hygiene products. Products with very short shelf lives could also suit compostable packaging. London-based Notpla makes plastic replacements from seaweed, a fast-growing carbon sequestering plant which breaks down anywhere within a few weeks. Co-founder Pierre Paslier said, "It's targeted at places where we pick something, we consume it, and it's over within minutes. And that's really where plastic is the worst material, because it's going to be around forever." Notpla's edible Uho water bubbles were handed to runners at the 2019 London Marathon. It has also partnered with the delivery service Just Eat to provide compostable condiment sachets that can be put straight into the household food waste bins, and has developed a seaweed coating to replace the plastic lining on cardboard takeaway boxes. Sander de Vreugde said materials innovation is one part of the puzzle, but truly dealing with plastic waste requires a hierarchy of action. Eliminate as much plastic as possible, then use recycled plastic. Finally, where virgin plastic are still required, use renewable feedstocks. He added, "It really needs to be done in that order." Miodonik said scientists, engineers and companies may be tempted to look at plastic and say, "Let's swap it for another thing, and that's now solved." But the truth is, you have to redesign the whole system if you're going to solve the problem.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamadi.
Islamadi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad.
Muhammad, praise be upon him, Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Salamun alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon all our dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is Youth Station. I'm your host, Hassanain from India, and we have Sayyid Jafar. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum, Brother Hassanain.
Where are you from, brother?
I am from America, specifically from Houston, Texas. So I was born and brought up over there.
And what are you doing here?
So right now I am studying in the seminary over here.
Okay, so I'm doing somewhat the same thing. So, brother, you live in America, right?
Yes.
So, over there, I see, like, in fact, everywhere around the world, like, we're living in a place, you know, people are completely dissolved in this dunya or this world, where no one cares what's happening around them, and no one cares about the akhirat or the hereafter, when no one cares about halal, haram, and people are getting materialistic. What do you think in the West, among youth, what does spirituality mean over there?
They know what the word spirit is. It has something to do with an energy that's around your physical body, but not that many people are into the spiritual sciences or in spirituality in general, as a whole. And the main reason for this is the technological advances, the, in a sense, easiness the world gives.
Yeah.
Where they've left the spiritual bounds of, I guess, thought, and they moved more towards the physical, the apparent, things you can see right in front of you, right?
Yeah.
It's not, oh, look, I should probably help them out because they probably need help, because, you know, it's within me to help someone out. It's, no, am I getting paid to do this? Then I'll do it.
Yeah.
Right? It's, do I have the flashiest car? Do I have the nicest phone?
Okay,
these are the main, like, topics that youth are invested in nowadays.
Okay, first, for our dear listeners, like, you know, I guess before we discuss about the people in the West and their idea of spirituality, let's just discuss about spirituality itself. And we can discuss about its consequences, and is it being followed? Are people away from it? And are people against it? So, spirituality, as we know, like, we have a general thinking idea in our minds that spirituality is the awareness of God. You get God way, you get God conscious, and you get, you know, you somewhat detach yourself from this materialistic world. And you try to get to know the actual truth, the emerging of the universe and all, the existence of God.
See, this is one stereotype when you introduce the concept of spirituality. What people think is, okay, so now you're going to, you know, take off all your name brand clothes. You're going to go in barefoot. You're going to sit on the street and you're going to ask for people's money.
Not even street. You know, one thing that people have about spirituality is, you know, you leave everything. You go to a jungle. You meditate there for years and years.
See, that's the wrong image people have made about spirituality. You leave everything and you, in a sense, you cut yourself away from the physical world. And suppose the physical necessities, and you cut yourself from these people as well. You go and seclude yourself in, suppose, a forest or in a mountaintop or something like that on your own. Look, in my opinion, it's not.
Okay, does the spirituality include detaching ourselves from the world?
It is, but in our sense of the word, it also means being a bridge between the two. Don't be either too, in a sense, too spiritual, in the negative manner where, you know, oh, no, I'm not going to wear any clothes now because, you know, it's attaching me to the world, right? It's attaching
that
me to the physically
sense, right?
To the physical world, right? I'm not going to drive a car now. I'm just going to walk everywhere. Okay, that's fine. That's, like, probably good for your health as well. But don't take it to that extent where you're like, look, nothing physical because, you know, I'm a spiritual person, right? And then on the other side, you got, you know, oh, maybe five cars isn't enough for me. Maybe I should get a sixth one, right? You know, three houses isn't really doing it. Maybe I should get a fourth one with, like, 10 bedrooms in it instead of seven, right? Where you go a little too much into the physical world, right? Where all of your basis is physical, right? It's the amount of things you have, the quality of things you have. And at the end of the day,
like, the desire of wanting more.
Yeah. Well, that's human desire, right?
Yeah.
We're not happy with what we have. We want more.
Right.
We're never going to be satisfied.
Yeah. Oh, dear listeners, let's take a short break over here and we'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back, dear audience. And before the break, we were discussing about spirituality with Brother Sayyid Jafar. And now we continue.
When you open yourself to spirituality, you realize that, look, the second you leave this, say, anchor of this animalness that we have as mm-hmm. humans, right?
Yeah.
This desire to just take everything that we can, which whatever we can get our hands on.
Yeah.
The second you drop this idea and you look at the world in a bigger picture,
yeah.
right? You get out of yourself,
mm-hmm.
in a sense, right? You don't think me, you think us,
right.
you think we, mm-hmm. right? You think of the society in a whole. You think yeah. of, suppose, religion in a whole.
Yeah.
You think of the cosmos in a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Then you really understand, bro, we are nothing.
Right.
Right? Why are we trying to fluff ourselves up so much?
Mm-hmm. So what are we supposed to do over here? Like, because you know what, like, detaching from the world doesn't make any sense, because after all, you have to live in this world, you have to work, you have to do business, buy or sell
goods, fine.
Everything, to fulfill your needs, right?
That's fine. You have to do it to such an extent where the minimum, I guess, not even the minimum, enough for you to move on, to move
what
forward
do you mean?
In
like,
this world.
You shouldn't work more?
No, as in you work to an
more?
Extent where you find a change in yourself. You're moving forward. You're not stagnant,
mm-hmm.
right? In a sense, there's some growth in you,
mm-hmm.
right? Whether that's physically, whether that's spiritually, whether that's mentally,
yeah,
right? There has to be some growth. You got to be getting to there should be an end game here.
So you're trying to say that there should be a growth while you work a corporate job.
Why not?
Growth.
Do you
want to
stay in? No, no. Okay, so let me break it down, because you said corporate. Let me break it down this way. Do you want to stay? Suppose you're a secretary. You want to stay a secretary for 25 years?
Okay, you're talking about that,
right?
Bro. Uh-huh.
There should,
but exactly, right? Okay, well, someone's secretary, right? Like,
right.
After that, if they become something, you know, what would the post that comes after secretary? Like, suppose manager.
Yeah.
Right? But you're saying that we should work to an extent which is enough for us and what fulfill our needs.
It's not just fulfilling our needs. It's fulfilling our needs. That's to the betterment of society.
There you go.
In a whole.
There you
right?
go. A point.
It's not just me. It's what can I do to make this society better? What is my footprint going to be in this society?
Right.
Or am I just going to be one of those guys who get brushed off in history, say, mm-hmm. 50 years from now, say, 200 years from now, when they're reading
right.
history? Oh, yeah, he was just this one guy who did this one thing. You know, he didn't really have an impact on the world.
Okay, so now we have come to this point that we can say that spirituality is, you know, working in the same world. But you look the people around you. You look, you care for the society. You're not selfish. You're not greedy. Mm. Am I right?
Yeah, to such an extent, when you open your heart to spirituality
mm-hmm.
and you understand your position in the face of the world, right?
Right.
It doesn't just have to be a social social position. It's not the status you hold.
Be?
It's not the status that you hold in society.
What should
it's
it be?
Your job for this society, right? Our job as this generation. Look, to some extent, I guess in the beginning, yeah, you want to, in a sense, live a little. But there is a part of your life where you got to start looking out for the next generation as well. What we have, safeguard what we got, and at least let it reach the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
Don't kill it off here,
yeah.
right? Say, like, for example,
like taking care of the environment.
Exactly. That's one example. Just look, a more humanistic example would be, right, something that's really affecting society nowadays, technology.
Right.
Look, 40, 50 years ago,
mm-hmm.
say, okay, we'll go even more back. 100 years ago, the concept of cars wasn't as advanced as it is now.
Yeah.
The concept of gasoline or, say, now, electric cars. Self-driving cars, right?
Yeah.
That wasn't even thinkable. It was unfathomable at that time. Mm-hmm. Right? But now it's here. Right? We are making steps. We are moving forward. But the problem is, while we're moving forward, we're not realizing the negative effect it has on everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Back in the day, it's probably one phone for the whole family. And what was it? It was a phone attached to the wall. You go in there, you put in your number, you talk to someone. Right?
Are you saying that we should stop moving forward, or we should lower our speed of moving forward?
No. That's not what I'm saying. Remember, I said spirituality to an extent is growing, mm-hmm. right? You have to move forward. If you're stagnant, look, what happens to stagnant cells in a body, right? Mm-hmm. If a cell isn't doing its job, it's not moving forward, it dies. The same thing happens to humans.
Yeah.
But it's not the typical meaning of death,
mm-hmm.
right? It's you die on the inside. You have no purpose in your life then. You're just moving around doing your thing. 70 years go by, but you have nothing to account for. You have no allocates you can go back to and say, oh, look, I did this. I made a difference.
Mm-hmm.
No, you did your thing and you left. And you're going to be forgotten in history. With spirituality, you don't take it to the extreme version that the West has made, where, oh, you detach yourself completely from society, you don't talk to anyone, you don't wear any, suppose, name brand, forget even name brand, you don't wear stitched clothing.
Mm-hmm.
They go to that extent. You sit around in, like, a cloth with no stitch, preferably white, because, you know, you can't show color, mm-hmm. you're spiritual, and you're just sitting around all day doing nothing. That's not what spiritual mm-hmm. means. You have to be making a difference in the world as well. That's the problem nowadays.
Yeah.
People are worried about, how do I look? What am I going to do? Where am I going to go? Instead of, how can I help this person now? Maybe they need help.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I can make a difference in their life.
Yeah.
Who knows? $1, $5 here or there could make a difference.
But it's normal, right? The person being worried about himself.
That's fine.
About his position.
But the problem is, if you think too much into that, you close yourself off from the world. And it's not, what can I do for the world? It's what the world can do for me. And at that moment, you become spiritually stagnant.
Okay, so you defining spirituality as serving the society.
In a sense.
What does Islam say about it?
Look, spirituality, if you break that word up.
God conscious.
You break that word up. You get the study of being spiritual. Spirituality. You break spiritual up.
Uh-huh.
It's understanding the spirit. Right? Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, we all have a spirit within us. This physical body, this is going to go away.
Yeah.
The real thing, what really makes you, you,
it's
isn't your physical body.
Uh-huh.
It's your spirit.
Right.
Right? And that spirit's goal is to reach as close as it can to God.
Right.
Right? What do we call God? Kamal. The highest of the high.
Right.
The perfection. Absolute perfection.
Mm-hmm.
What is our spirit's goal? To reach that perfection.
Spirituality, it can be defined as, you know, always being God conscious. You know, working according to what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has commanded us.
Exactly. Right? I'm not saying don't work. I'm not saying, oh, look, if you work in a corporate, you know, suppose building or warehouse, you know, quit your job now. You know, you're not spiritual. No. Who said that's not spiritual? You're working to, suppose, get money for your family to bring up your kids.
Right.
To show them the right way.
Right.
Do you not think God wants you to do that? Who's saying that's going against spirituality?
God has asked us to do that, in fact.
Exactly. Who said it's one or the other? Why can't it be both?
Yeah.
You put these two in such a way where you're growing spiritually and physically.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, you're growing mentally as well. There's a growth within you as time passes.
Thank you so much, Sayyid Jaffa, and thank you so much, dear audience, for staying with us. I would like to end this conversation with the hadith from Holy Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. in which he states that, "Verily Allah loves the young man who spends his entire youth in the obedience of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala." With that being said, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.